Hello and welcome to AAPT Comics Podcast, Episode 9, the official comics podcast for AAPTcomics.com. With me is co-host Forrest Hollingsworth.
Hello, that's Forrest with two R's, and I'm a collector's edition.
And I'm your other co-host, David Brook. Connor Christensen's not going to be on the show today, unfortunately, so sad for us. But we do have another guest who's going to be filling in that time. That's Christopher Savella. We'll be interviewing him later in the show, talking about his latest books and what's coming up for him, as well as questions about the craft and stuff like that. To kick off our show, we usually talk about the news, the latest news in the comic book industry, the stuff that's striking us and striking fans, be it on social media or message boards. Yeah, we look at all the message boards for this stuff. Real research stuff.
I read them all.
You got to.
My eyes are so tired.
We're that thorough. The top of the news for us this week is Tom Taylor's deceased. Did I say that right? DC-eased or deceased. It's something he's been hyping for, about a week now, I think? Maybe a week and a half?
Yeah.
He's been on Twitter tweeting little fragments of sentences, kind of like little clues. I actually haven't done the work and pieced all those clues together. What do you think, Forrest? What's your take on this news? This is Tom Taylor doing, I guess, an event series for DC Comics?
Yeah, so it's basically, as far as, other sites have gotten reviews or interviews with Tom Taylor and kind of asked him some questions about it or asked DC some questions about it. And as far as I can suss out, it's basically DC does zombies.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And knowing that, I actually love the title, which is capital D, capital C, eased.
Definitely so clever.
DC eased, as you were alluding to earlier. And those snippets that he was tweeting out and posting on his Facebook, and he actually did a really cool kind of social media campaign where he had people
go into his crazy.
Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, all across the net. And I bet he's getting more hits to some of those pages than he's gotten in quite a while, because a lot of comics fans kind of aggregate to either the big sites or a creator's Twitter. And I actually kind of liked following that rabbit trail. Mm-hmm. I thought that was really cool, especially when you're tweeting out things like, and then, Superman punched so-and-so through the chest.
Mm-hmm.
Or this was the last time that the Justice League was together. They all died. That's not the exact wording. Tom Taylor is a much better writer than me, but that was the gist of it. And so initially, I thought that it was going to be Injustice 3, as he's written the first two Injustice series. Mm-hmm. I thought it was maybe going to be a spinoff of that or an Injustice continuation into DC's Black Label imprint. But it's actually just a apocalypse story about more than half of the world becoming infected by a really horrible disease that turns people into kind of mindless zombies. So it is a zombie story. The cover art makes it look like, drawn by Greg Capullo, makes it look like Batman is kind of the central figure. But Tom Taylor has gone ahead and said, this is a Justice League story. It is about how the Justice League bands together and tries to fend off the end of the world, and also about what happens when they realize they can't. And knowing, how well Tom ties together heroism, especially in the face of insurmountable odds like that, which he did really well in X-Men Red, as well as All New Wolverine, I'm really, really excited to see where he takes that.
They also revealed a variant cover with, I think, Joker holding a red balloon, and you can see his face through it, and in front of him is Robin. He's sort of creepily handing him the balloon, and it just, the way they did the font on Deceased and then the balloon, it just made me think of It, the movie It.
Yeah, absolutely.
It definitely has a really creepy vibe. It threw me off, though, because I was like, wait, is this some sort of It-DC combo?
Yeah, and that's just the variant cover. I think it's just a little weirdsy.
Right.
Yeah.
We should also mention Trevor Hairsign is the artist on the series, along with Stefano Gaudiano. And it's coming out May 1st. I'm excited. I'm still kind of confused if it's going to be in canon or not, or if it's some alternate dimension thing, or I don't know.
I have the feeling it's probably an alternate dimension thing, just like Marvel Zombies was.
Right.
Although Deadpool remembers Marvel Zombies and lived through it, actually. So there's probably one DC character that will remember all of it.
Right, just for like the tongue-in-cheek, wink-wink kind of thing.
Right.
Next up in our news, Cullen Bunn came out and did an interview talking about X-Men Blue storylines that he wanted to tell but never got to. First and foremost, the thing that popped in my mind when I saw this is, you never see writers do this. Possibly because they don't want people stealing their ideas, but also because you know, they don't want to give away the goat if they're going to tell him eventually, which makes me think he maybe Marvel doesn't want him telling X-Men stories anymore or something.
Yeah, it's interesting. And, you know, they were questions that people were asking on Tumblr.
Mm-hmm.
They're actually just fan-submitted questions to his Tumblr blog. So I don't know if there's just no editorial oversight there. I've seen Kieran Gillen and Brian Michael Bendis ask questions before, but they're or answer questions before, but they're obviously really, really safe questions to answer.
Right.
Like, do you like writing Miles Morales? Yeah. You know?
Right.
Yes. Colin's, some of his answers are like, what was the plan for Magneto? And did you feel like there was a lot of editorial mishaps or mishandling in how your Magneto story ended up panning out? And Colin writes a really long response that's like, you know, this was my plan for Magneto. This is what happened. I don't feel like the editors messed with it at all, but it was an interesting time to be at Marvel. Mm-hmm. As far as I know, there was no behind the scenes stuff happening, but it was challenging to write such and such. It's weird, you know, you don't see it very often. You're definitely right about that. And it does seem to indicate that he's very done with X-Men.
It makes me think he might be bitter based on the fact that he's revealing things like the young X-Men that were pulled from the past were going to become the Exiles. By just saying that, does he nullify the fact that that can't happen now? I mean, I guess it can't now that since those characters are kind of either dead or being replaced.
Right.
Yeah.
And we've talked before about the marketplace of ideas that happens in the Marvel's writing retreats that they mm-hmm. do, I think, a couple times a year. You know, that's where the idea came out. Donny Cates pitched the idea that Colossus and Kitty Pryde wouldn't get married, but Rogue and Gambit would. So it's – I don't want to say too much or assume too much, but it's possible that Colin lost that marketplace of ideas and feels a little bitter and, you know, feels protective of his ideas and wants to see if people like them, you know, wants a little bit of gratification.
Right.
Or maybe he just wants to talk him out and kind of do a moratorium of the writing process in general. And maybe that's empowering and fulfilling to him enough to just say the things you're thinking about.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. And I mean, a couple months ago, he tweeted like he's going to have a fan group or something. And maybe he's doing that for his fan group, like giving them these ideas so they can go, oh, yeah, that would have been a cool way to go, but it's obviously not going to be the way they go.
Yeah. And all the X-Men are dead to me. No. but yeah, you know, he's, as we've said before, the official comic book writer of the AIPD Comics podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And his creator-owned projects are very good. Harrow County is one of my favorite horror comics of all time, and I love to see that he's really leaning into that angle. I know a lot of people love a lot of the horror stuff he's working on with Tyler Crook and a bunch of others,
sure.
Bone Parish and some of those other projects. So maybe he's just decided to go that route, and he's fine talking out the ideas that he doesn't see happening in the foreseeable future.
People definitely crave Cullen Bunn horror stories, much like this week. People on Twitter craving an alternate storyline where Gwen Stacy didn't die. I forget who broke the news. I think it was
IDW's chief of marketing or editor, head exec editor or something like that. Chris Rial asked on Twitter,
yep,
just for fun, what never-before-collected comic series do you want collected? And a Twitter user named Comic Keys said, there's a Mexican publisher that has put out this book.
Yeah, the publisher's La Prensa. And in it, they did a 45 original issue run where Gwen Stacy did not break her neck on that bridge. And they go off and get married.
Yeah, so it's basically an alternate universe where Gwen Stacy did not die. Because
right.
The Mexican publisher La Prensa was worried that Mexican readers would not continue reading after Gwen Stacy died, which is really interesting to me, actually, that they were so worried that Spider-Man wasn't the drawing force of the books that Gwen was.
Right, right. They were, like, worried that they were going to lose that, like, soap opera melodrama or something.
Right, and soaps are incredibly popular throughout Latin America, South America and stuff. So that's a really good insight. That could absolutely be it.
It's crazy to me that Marvel would be cool with it, but I guess they got to do whatever they wanted, thinking that no one would ever in like America go to another country down in South America and pick up one of these books.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Maybe they think their entire audience doesn't speak Spanish either. Who knows? At the time, anyway. You know what's crazy to me is, like, we have all these alternate dimensions within the universes. But now we have this alternate dimension outside of the universe in our reality.
Right.
I'm actually looking for, knowing C.B. Cebulski right now and how he's kind of a mover and a shaker trying to bring back this nostalgic vibe with stories or with creators, like how he said he was going to work with John Byrne. That's just something that popped in my head. One example of that, I could see him totally getting this translated and publishing this, and I think fans would eat it up.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the same as them bringing back Conan after 15 years working with Rob Liefeld. There's all sorts of stuff there. They did La Prensa, I'm looking it up now. They published 44 of these issues and then subsequently lost the Marvel license.
Oh.
So it's possible that Marvel was like, wait, you're doing what?
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Right.
But at now, it's very possible that the flip side of that is them being like, Marvel's like, you did what? Cool.
Right. Yeah.
You know, because CB is very much like that. You're right. I will caution people. I saw on Twitter someone say, you do realize that if these are all collected, it is entirely the artist was just drawing Gwen Stacy ass shots. Right. And they posted a bunch of pictures. I mean, it's at least 8 to 16, more than one or two, where Gwen is like at the center of the panel. Mm-hmm. Her backside is facing the viewer, and like her jeans, her dress, her like biking leather, everything is so tight. Mm-hmm. She's like always bent over. It's really like, oh, okay. They definitely made an editorial direction that was like, or decision that was like, the people want Gwen Stacy. The people want Gwen Stacy.
Right, right.
You know?
Yeah.
So I don't know how that would play to people right now.
Hey, you know, I just interviewed two of the creators behind Astro Hustle, this book that's coming out in a couple weeks. And their book is sort of inspired by disco of the 70s and how there's like there was a sexual revolution at the time. Maybe that's why that artist was going in that route, even though it is exploitive. Maybe we get some butt shots of Peter. I don't know. Do we? Did anyone point that out yet?
If they have pointed it out, I haven't seen it. If that exists, I want it.
Equal opportunist butt shot. That's what we want.
Well, that spandex is way tighter than Gwen's pants.
That's true.
Come on.
That's true.
Yeah.
Okay, moving on. In our last bit of news, Scott Snyder and Greg Capullo's upcoming Batman book will be their last together, supposedly. And this book is a DC Black Label book. We've got some art to go with it where Batman's sort of walking towards us. He's got this lantern, which appears to have Joker's head in it. You can see the green hair and his smile. That's my take anyway. Although it is odd that he's holding a lantern. Makes you think there's some sort of Green Lantern connection. Fans are going to eat this up. We already know that.
Oh, no doubt.
And I mean, the Snyder Capullo magic. I don't know. I don't believe this is their last Batman story, but that's how they're pitching it.
Yeah, I was kind of confused when I read the initial solicit if they were saying it's the last time Scott Snyder and Greg Capullo were ever going to work together, or if it was their last Batman story.
Right.
Either way, and if they're intentionally playing into that, like kind of up in the air, it could be either one. Fans are going to eat it up.
I mean, it is called Batman Last Night on Earth, and it's a 3-issue series. I'm assuming since it's DC Black Label, it's probably a larger format too, like Batman Damned.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Anyway, that's out May 29th. I'm looking forward to it. It's kind of fun to watch the evolution of these two working together over the years, from just doing regular Batman to doing DC Metal.
I think it's interesting because it's basically a final word from DC that is, yes, we're going forward with Black Label.
Yeah, actually, no, that makes me excited because I was a little worried there they might cut away. I love the idea of like an adult line, especially for DC, since most of their books are not really rated R. Most of them, like Wonder Woman and Superman, they do have adult themes, but they're mostly for all ages.
Right, yeah. Justice League Dark is like the hardest lean into horror and stuff I've seen from them in a while.
Yeah.
But I crave even something a little bit beyond that, or at least writing more into the adult themes. Sometimes they'll let the art get a little wild. Scott Snyder's Swamp Thing run is really creepy, really gross, really scary. But seeing that they're continuing with Black Label after the problems that Batman Damned has had with cancellations, with bat penis, bat wang, whatever you want to call it, controversies and stuff, this is a really good step forward. And I'm excited for that at the very least. And I really do love, like you called out, the attention that they're giving to printing them.
Yes.
I know that they're a little bit more expensive, but they're coming out in these really nice, like, glossy magazine print, larger format things. They feel like collector's items, mm-hmm. even on the shelf. And that's cool.
Yeah, I mean, you look at other industries like wine. There are different levels of wine you can get. Whereas with comics, generally, they're all the same price, the same shape, the same size, the same number of pages. So it's kind of cool to see them experimenting with different formats.
Yeah, absolutely. And if it truly is the last Batman story these guys are telling, I can't imagine a better way to have it told or collected.
You are so freaking true.
I am true.
Okay, guys, next up in our show, we talk about our favorite books from last week, the top books from last week. And to start this section of our show, we always talk about comicbookroundup.com, the website that's basically Rotten Tomatoes for comic book reviews. And we pick, we take the top two scores with at least three, I think, reviews so that it's fair, because there are a couple books that only have one review and maybe have a 10. That doesn't seem fair to me. The book that was the second highest rated was James Bond 007 number 4 from Dynamite Entertainment. It had a 9.2. This book is highly regarded by one of our reviewers at AIPTcomics.com, Nathan Simmons, and it's written by Greg Pak with art by Stephen Mooney. Personally, I need to read this right now because Stephen Mooney is one of my favorite artists in the indie scene. He did a series called Half Past Danger, which he wrote and drew, which is sort of like Indiana Jones meets dinosaurs. He's got that action-adventure stuff locked down, so I can see why it's ranked second.
It's really, really rare to see a franchise comic ranked that highly. Obviously, James Bond is such a popular name that it kind of supersedes the quote-unquote franchise-ness that other things might, but mm-hmm. I was surprised to see it rank so highly, and especially a fourth issue, because you'll see issues like a first issue or a second issue will get a ton of reviews and a ton of really positive reviews, but after that, the numbers will drop off, both in the number of people reviewing it as well as the high ratedness, unless it's something like Saga. So I was really surprised to see James Bond on here this week, and that makes me more inherently inclined to believe that it is pretty good.
And, you know, I'm a huge Greg Pak fan, so I'm going to have to read it anyway. Warren Ellis was, I think, the one who kicked off James Bond at Dynamite years ago. It was a pretty good series at the time. What's your second pick, Forrest?
My number two pick, my second of the picks, my number of not number one pick of the mm-hmm. week is Coda number 9, written by Cy Spurrier with art by Matthias Bergara. I've talked up Coda before on this show. If you check out my Twitter, I'm talking up Coda all the time. I don't necessarily want to spend my time repitching it, but what it basically is a kind of deconstructed post-J.R.R. Tolkien fantasy world. It's got a little bit of like a Mad Max on mushrooms plus Mobius vibe to it. And that's just like the surface level of the world. We're entering the final arc here. It's a 12-issue maxi series from these guys. And this is kind of the first part of the final act. It has been exclusively about the main character, Hum, who is like a former bard, and his wife, Circa. And it's really starting to take a turn where it's stepping away from the world and looking more about the complexities of their relationship. And Hum has done something that has severely hurt Circa, although he thought he was doing the right thing. And it's starting to look at, Cy tweeted out, you know, quintessential, the guy you thought was a good guy turns out to actually be a total asshole story.
Yeah.
And I really love that. Hum has been writing a journal throughout the entire comic so far, where he's basically writing the story. He's the narration, and it's in little paper cutouts with his handwriting. And this issue starts with him trying to be more honest with himself. And so you'll see various paper cutouts, and the lines are crossed out. And they're approaching a city, and he says, at first, he says, we made our way there whenever we felt like it, because he has this whole facade of not being caring and not trying hard, and that's crossed out, and he says, I headed straight there, because that's significantly more honest, and Circa has basically called him out for not being honest and not being the man that he thinks he is. And so it's kind of starting to tear down the whole meta-narrative of both Hum as a character and also what the comic has been presenting to you.
Hmm.
while also maintaining its really, really high level of world building and artistry on behalf of Bergara. And I'm just absolutely blown away by it. It was listed in last year's or 2018's Best of Maxi series on AIPTComics.com. And I'm telling you right now, I will list it for 2019 as well, because it is fantastic.
Spoiler alert. You know, speaking of high level, my second pick for the week is High Level, number one, by Rob Sheridan and Barnaby Bagenda, with color by Romulo Fajardo Jr. This is a series I've been excited about since San Diego Comic-Con, when I got to talk to Sheridan about this series. He is doing this sort of punk, cyberpunk thing, where there's a city, a mythical city called High Level, where there are people who think it's this place that's basically like pulling in people and then just churning them out, like using them. Whereas others think it's like heaven. And in a large way, I think the High Level is almost like religion. It's like symbolic for religion. And it's definitely an opium of the people. And that's a concept that's quite interesting. Then also we have a female protagonist who is a loner on her own, kind of living her own life and wanting to live her own life. And it's interesting that she's getting pulled into not only this high level dream that everyone has, but also people who want to potentially knock down this mythical city for what it's doing, really. And we don't know yet. So there's a big mystery there. It's also beautifully rendered. I had a lot of fun. I'm a sucker for sci-fi stories, especially with comics, because when you have sci-fi and comics, you can go so much further than a movie, be it concept or visuals. And I have a feeling this series is going to be like that. And this is a DC Vertigo book, I should mention, one of their latest.
Yeah, that sounds really great. You know, Nine Inch Nails is like my favorite band of all time.
Oh, really?
At the very least, The Fragile is my favorite album of all time.
Yeah.
And Rob, the writer, was with Nine Inch Nails for a really long time. And he is also one of the founding members of How to Destroy Angels, Trent Reznor's other project. And I saw him tweeting out, you know, like, it has been a lifelong dream since I was like single-digit years old to have a comic on the shelves. So this is like the most creatively fulfilling thing that I've ever done. And honestly, if that supersedes the work you did with Nine Inch Nails, I'm going to check out your comic. So I'm really excited to check it out when I get a chance.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. He definitely has a unique perspective. I'm going to just say that. Okay, guys, the number one pick, according to comicbookroundup.com, the number one comic, the highest reviewed comic, I should say, with a 9.4 is Bitterroot number 4, a book I have not read, but I do know that Ed Eisner has read it, because back on February 13th, he tweeted himself with Bitterroot in his hand saying he has his weekend of reading ready, which I think is amazing. I mean, he's like a 70, 80-something-year-old comedian reading this new indie book. Like, I don't even know how he got it in his hands. Do you know anything about how Ed Eisner got this in his hands? Did you know he had it?
There was like a bag of gifts behind him in the photo. I did I really got into my CSI shit there.
Yeah.
And it was close to Valentine's Day, so maybe it was a present.
Zoom in, enhance.
Yeah,
zoom in,
enhance. That's my guess.
Anyway, it's a series I need to catch up on. I think I read the first issue and I wasn't blown away, but you know what? You got to give every series, at least the first two issues, a chance.
Absolutely. And
9 times out of 10, the story doesn't really start till the second issue anyway.
And David F. Walker, the writer there, he's a really, really talented guy. And he's really feeling Bitterroot enough that he's launched his own publishing company called Solid Comics. He said that he's going to continue working with other publishers to tell stories that are more appropriate for other mainstream publishers. But basically, he said, working on Bitterroot has empowered me to tell stories that are entirely my own, that I completely own, that I feel are right for other mainstream publishers. And so I'm launching my own publishing company where I will primarily be telling stories where I'm writing or working with another artist to tell a story. So I'm interested to see where everything goes with that. They've announced the first two series. I think, you know, if people love Bitterroot this much, I'm sure people will be excited to see what he can do when he's not answering to anyone.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sky's the limit. I'm interested in your number one pick, Forrest.
My number one pick is Venom number 11, written by Donnie Cates with art by Ryan Stegman. I've said before that there's not a week where Venom comes out that it won't be on my list. This is the truest that statement has ever been. If I were reviewing this for the site, I would have given it a 10 out of 10. It's a perfect issue. It's similar to Coda almost unpacks everything or tears down everything we thought we knew about the story so far, the relationship between Eddie and the symbiote, going all the way back to issue one. Donnie has tweeted out saying, you know, I was placing little hints of this throughout the story all the way going forward to now. And I cannot possibly bring myself to spoil what happens here, but you basically find out that the symbiote has been lying to Eddie, and the severity of those lies is mind-boggling. I actually stealth read this comic at work, and I was scrolling through the pages, and I was like, oh fuck, oh shit, oh holy shit, oh fuck. And then I'm still thinking about it. I still can bring myself to the moment where I reach that last page, that cliffhanger, and I cannot believe that I have to wait until like the 20th of next month for that payoff. And I haven't felt that way about comics in like a year.
Yeah, Cates is just keeps throwing you these curveballs at you, and you're like, whoa, what? Wait, what?
Yeah. And to do so with a character that hasn't really been given that depth before, right. A character that I love nonetheless, I'm literally wearing a Venom t-shirt. I have a Venom keychain and a Venom water bottle. Like, it's probably my favorite character of all time.
And he's only getting better.
And he's only getting better. And I don't think he's been given this level of emotional complexity before. And I really love the payoff of that very much. And I just can't wait to see where they go from here. And seriously, if you just want to tweet at me after you read this issue, please do, because I'd love to talk about it.
I gave it a 9 out of 10. I reviewed it for aptcomics.com. And I am also excited, but I just want to say one thing. It worries me that, I don't want to spoil anything, if the symbiote is lying to Eddie and potentially inserting false memories or taking away memories or whatever, you get down a road where, you know, Cates could literally rewrite his entire backstory because we don't know what's real, what's not. And that's a little bit, it's kind of a dangerous place to go for fans who like the history already.
Sure. Absolutely. I can totally see that angle. I think that there's a really interesting thing to be said for dangerousness of this close of a relationship or this dependent of a relationship, right, and how it can make everything that you feel about a partner or about your world feel so real and changeable and malleable. And I'm interested to see to that extent, though, where we find other characters outside of Donnie and the, or not Donnie, outside of Eddie and the symbiote saying, Eddie, we have a ton of stuff that says that's not true.
Right.
You're really, really lost in your own mind here. The symbiote calls it the abyss. So I think it's possible that there's a good median there.
Sure. I just want to know how they're going to get back together. I mean, they got to break up now.
Oh, man, I know. I'm really waiting for the symbiote to, like, leave him and then have a whole we were on a break scene from Friends.
Oh, they have their own apartments.
Yeah, they have their own apartments.
The symbiote picks up the phone, starts dialing his number, puts it back down, shakes its head.
Puts its greasy little stub up to the window.
Okay, guys, so my number one pick was Aquaman number 45. I haven't actually been reading this series too in-depth, but I picked up this issue out of curiosity. Kelly Sue DeConnick wrote this book with Robson Rocha on art, and I am a sucker for, like, mythical creationist stories. This entire issue is a creation story about water and salt, two gods that got with each other, created the ocean. And that's just the start of it. And there's gods upon gods. And she's basically created this new hierarchy of gods. So we're not talking Zeus here. We're talking more elemental gods. And from those elemental gods, more kind of sub-elemental gods came out of it. And she's building up this... Basically, she's building all of this to make a new villain for Aquaman to fight. But at the same time, if it's all in canon, there's like a whole new layer of gods in the DC universe.
Sure.
That other writers could pull into their stories. And it's a really beautiful issue in the way she writes this mythical backstory about the gods and how Earth was created and all this. I'm a sucker for those kind of stories. If that's something that's your interest to you, you're going to love it.
Absolutely. Yeah.
If you like storytelling, you're going to love that issue.
I have a quick story about, you know, finding out about the primordial evils and elementals and stuff, and like the delivery of how I found out that they were as cool as possible.
Yeah.
I was in college a couple of years ago, and we had an 8 a.m. class learning about Greek mythology. And this girl next to me had this really tall metal cup. And mm-hmm. the professor was discussing all the primordial evils, like you're saying, you know, and he said Hades is actually not the god of the underworld, or he's not the god of darkness, like you're probably led to believe. And she accidentally drops her cup, and it rolls all the way down the metal steps, this mm-hmm. metal cup, clink, 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 all the way down. And he looks directly up at her and goes, Tartarus is actually the god of evil.
That's funny.
And I was like, I will never forget that. I'll forget all the other shit you said, but Tartarus is cool. You know, if Tartarus shows up in Aquaman, I will read it.
Yeah. That's a note to you teachers out there listening. Try to do something a little more funny and off the cuff. And your students might learn more. Maybe. I don't know. Okay, guys, in our next segment called Dream Teams, we're going to be picking our ultimate team for whatever reason. It's up in the air. It doesn't matter which publisher they're from. It's going to be a super duper team. And we're doing this thanks to Logan and Cyclops joining forces in an Uncanny X-Men number 12. Two characters that were dead for years. Years, right? Yeah.
And now they're a long time, both of them, yeah.
Now they're both alive. They both came back in different ways. One long, drawn-out story. The other kind of just popped in. We both picked three characters for this trio team.
Yes. Hit me.
I'm going to start with Etrigan. He's one of my favorite DC Comics heroes. Or maybe not a hero.
Interesting.
I love the idea of this character that like is actually a demon in hell, and he's like clinging to a human because of some curse or whatever. And so he's sort of forced to do heroic deeds based on the moment. And also he, you know, rhymes all of his dialogue. And he's kind of like I wouldn't say he's the strength on my team, the superpower like muscle, but there's going to be a sort of a theme going, and his connection to hell is why he's on my team.
Interesting. Okay. The first of mine is Mania, the female clone Venom symbiote.
Oh, okay.
Whose most famous host was Andy Benton. Primarily in the comics written by Rick Remender and Colin Bunn. I like her quite a bit. And there's a little bit of a hell connection there, too.
Yeah, kind of evil.
Yeah, kind of, you know. I like Venom using guns and being stealthy and badass with, I don't know, fucking pouches and stuff. I think it's cool in the end.
I mean, every character should have pouches. It actually, my next pick has pouches, and it's Hellboy. I think he has pouches sometimes.
Yeah, he's got at least the hip holster. Yeah.
Yeah, there you go. He is kind of the muscle on this team, even though I think Etrigan may be as strong, if not stronger. Again, they both have connections to hell, and they're both powerful. And that's all I'll say, because my team has a pretty cool name. I don't want to spoil it.
Oh, my team name is bad. I'm just proud of the people that okay. I picked.
What's your second pick on your team?
My second pick is X-23.
Okay.
Laura Kinney. I really love her. She's my favorite comic book character of all time. You know, Venom is right there, neck and neck. Shout out Mania just before.
Yeah.
But, you know, I really love that Laura commits herself to a purpose, follows through, does so in a serious way, but also with an understanding that things are often morally gray.
Mm-hmm.
She cares about Gabby. She calls her her sister. She cares about the X-Men, but she also understands that sometimes the best way to deal with an issue, to deal with the evils that the X-Men face, is to cut off its head.
Oh, yeah.
And I really appreciate that.
Do whatever it takes.
Yeah.
All right. Rounding out my team, Scarlet Witch. Okay.
Oh, okay.
All right. Now, you know, depending on which Scarlet Witch we're talking about, because we've had the one that's kind of lost her mind and screwed over the entire Earth. That's kind of the one I want on this team. Her power set is really impressive, and I think it matches the other two because she brings in that magic element that could defeat any demon if need be. But also red. She's red. She wears a red costume. That's you know, it doesn't have to be that complicated. Can I tell you my team name, or should you go next?
Wait. Was the unifying element red?
No, not necessarily.
Okay. I thought it was hell, and then you were like, you know, red.
Hell is red. Come on.
Yeah, no, I got you.
Who's your third teammate?
My third is Spider-Gwen.
Okay.
And the unifying element here is, one, they're all women.
Uh-huh.
They're all like my female. They're all my favorite female characters. Actually, I just realized that they're all Marvel. I think you could definitely make the case for Liz from Hellboy. I love her as well. But I really love female characters that set themselves down a path. None of these characters are overly sexualized. You know, X-23 was in the past. She like had a really gross history with prostitution and stuff like that. But and I'm not saying that sex work is bad. To put that out there, I definitely want to make that clear, just that Tom Taylor did a really good job of making her a character that isn't just exclusively traumatized by that, and that owns her identity and is much more of a character than just the things that has happened to her. Gwen is also a perfect example of that. You know, we were just talking about how the Mexican publisher was like, well, Gwen died, the book's over.
Yeah.
You know, and a bunch of people felt that way. You know, all of Gwen's identity became her death. Spider-Gwen is the exact opposite response to that. Mania is the exact opposite response to how masculine Venom's issues can be. And I absolutely love that. So that's why I picked all of mine.
What's your team name?
My team name is Silent Strike.
Silent Strike.
Yeah.
Nice. Is that published at Image Comics? I feel like it should be.
I feel like it could be, yeah.
Mine is Red Vengeance.
So it is red.
Well, you know, red in multiple different meanings, you know.
Sure.
I like to think that Hellboy is sort of the leader, but Scarlet Witch takes over here and there. Etrigan is definitely the loose cannon who they have to rein in all the time. Our teams should team up.
Yeah, they would do well. You know, you got kind of a loud and angry one, and I got a quiet one.
But they're both badass.
Yeah, equally badass.
Equally, yes. Okay, guys, next up in our show, we're going to be talking about the books we're looking forward to the most next week. We tend to pick a lot of Marvel, but I don't know if we're going to do that this week. I'm going to. My pick for next week is Fantastic Four number 7 by Dan Slott and Aaron Cooter. Fantastic Four number 6 was everything I wanted in a Fantastic Four book, finally. The first 5 or so issues were a slow start, in my opinion, and it's starting to pick up. Cooter is doing excellent work, and it's got Galactus and Doctor Doom. So, I mean, really, what more can you ask from a Fantastic Four book?
Are they facing both of those at the same time?
Yeah. I don't want to spoil it. I think the cliffhanger of issue 6 was Doom is in control of Galactus.
Oh, they're going to die.
And they're on Earth. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay, so Death of the Fantastic Four, the event coming to your small screen soon.
Exactly.
So my pick is Martian Manhunter number 3, written by Steve Orlando with art by Riley Rossmo. I have given the first 2 issues of Martian Manhunter both 10 out of 10 over at AIPTComics.com when I reviewed them. I have, to my knowledge, never given 2 issues in a row 10 out of 10.
Wow. That's saying a lot.
So just what Steve is doing or writing in terms of Martian Manhunter and John Jones, or his Martian name, Zon Zones, as a identity crisis kind of story. And I don't mean that in terms of the event, but rather the actual issues. You know, Manhunter is trying to reconcile these unsavory things that he's done on Mars with this new human identity he's assumed. He's fleeing from something, and it's been hinted that he's done something not good, but he's going to become someone good. The person that we know becomes a member of the Justice League. And it's a story about what happens when you need to completely change your identity, and you really need to find out who you are through adversity. I think that there's a lot to be said for how it represents, in particular, the queer experience. There's a lot of things that are analogous to coming out or to changing your shape or to coming out of the closet and deciding who you are and maybe feeling shame about things you've done or the way you've looked and stuff, but also owning the good inside of you. And to tell that story with an alien who has come to Earth, who looks like a man, who is a police officer, who's maybe fleeing from something, takes it to this really crazy, fun, too bigger than life, but still also digestible human level. that comics does really, really well, and I like that quite a bit. Riley Rossmo's art on top of that, this fun, pulpy, exaggerated thing, matches up with that narrative really, really well, and I just can't imagine not liking this next issue, even if I think sometimes the Martian dialogue gets a little out of control.
I feel like Riley Rossmo should have all the Eisners.
Yes.
I think Correct. We both picked something that was like that is the epitome of a story that could only be told in comics.
Yes.
Especially absolutely. Fantastic Four, since we all know that it can't work as a movie.
It will never be adapted. No.
Kevin Feige says, hold my beer. Next up, we have an interview with Christopher Sabella, who is one of the primo artists in the indie scene, but also in other scenes as well. And we're going to be asking him a few questions today. Forrest, do you want to start off, kick off those questions?
Sure, absolutely. Chris, thank you so much for joining us, talking about Crowded, Shanghai Red, High Crimes, a whole bunch of other books you have as well. You know, I really wanted to hit on High Crimes, which you just reprinted, reproduced. What would be the word for that, would you say?
Re-released.
brought it back.
Yeah.
And it's the elevator pitch for it would be a maxi series about crimes on Everest. Is that appropriate, you think?
Yeah, our tagline was always a high altitude noir.
Okay.
So yeah, it's basically a crime / spy thriller set on Mount Everest.
And the artist on that is Ibrahim Mustafa, correct?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. Awesome. And I had a quick question for you about that. In terms of, you know, I know you're working on Crowded, which is immensely successful and has been adapted or picked up for a TV or movie adaption as well. When you're looking at a book that came out a while ago, like High Crimes, and you're re-releasing it, is it strange to put yourself back in that headspace?
A little bit. I mean, I had to go through and reread it to proof it and make sure we weren't screwing anything up. So I definitely had a lot of urges of things that I would, if I was writing it now, that I would do differently. But yeah, it's just like I don't want to George Lucas things. So I didn't want to go back, you know, like for good or for ill, that is the book that broke me into comics. And that is a book that I wrote. That's a book that taught me how to write comics. So yeah, it was super weird, and there was a lot of stuff in there that I would change if I could, but it just like doesn't, you know, it's the book that it was, and you know, no book ever comes out perfect. It's just finished. So that was finished. Yeah.
And there were no inclinations to put like a ghost Anakin anywhere in there.
No, I did write a one page teaser for a sequel, that Ibrahim never got it right. I don't think I ever actually sent him the script, but yeah, it was going to be a sequel that takes place on Mars.
Okay, awesome. Did you feel on the flip side of that there was anything as you were looking it over that you were like, wow, this is really cool? Like, I didn't realize maybe subconsciously that I was writing something this cool.
Yeah, I mean, it's been around long enough that, you know, I kind of adjusted to what it was, but yeah, there's a lot of stuff in there that I was like, good for you, I'm glad you did that. Like, I don't know, there was a lot of screwing around on that book and us trying to, you know, we didn't have an editor and we didn't have deadlines, so we could take our time and kind of do whatever we wanted, and we could, you know, turn the book 90 degrees for a couple pages if we wanted, because nobody could stop us. So I definitely like that, seeing like us kind of messing around and seeing what works and what doesn't, and just putting it on the page and hoping that, you know, it does work.
Speaking of screwing around, you know, that instantly made me think of House Amok, where there's conspiracy theories and organ thieves and all this other stuff going on. Can you talk a little bit about like what inspired this crazy good story?
Yeah, it was, I was listening, I got into a brief true crime resurgence, and I had been listening to a true crime podcast, and they were talking about a case of Folie à Deux, which is shared madness. So it's basically when two or more people kind of reinforce each other's insanity, and sort of help it grow. And there's been a couple cases of it, and I don't know, I just heard, you know, the term, like, shared madness. I never knew that there was a term for it, and then the more I looked into it, it was like, this is just, it's so, it's a real thing, but it's just so kind of inexplicable how, you know, this person that you love so much, like, is making you sicker all the time, and you're making them sicker, and it's like this weird feedback loop. And I knew there was something there, so I thought, like, well, a Madness of Two is interesting, but what if we did an entire family going insane together?
Right, sure. Right, yeah. And then put them on a road trip too.
Yeah.
Can I ask, is that concept connected at all to, like, a cult or a cult-like behavior? Do you know from your research?
Really. I mean, I'm sure there can, you know, cults sort of operate on a, it's intentional.
Yeah.
Like with Folly Ado, there's no intentionality there. It's just, you know, one person starts to believe something crazy, and then they convince the other person to believe it too. And then the other person starts adding to the narrative, and eventually, you know, they're sort of building this fictional world together. Whereas with cults, you know, there's sort of a brain in charge of it that is, you know, following a pattern to get people to believe in this stuff.
Right. It's like a top-down hierarchy rather than side-by-side.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same results, but yeah, much different ways of going about it, I guess.
You mentioned people feeding each other's narratives and kind of building a fantasy together. Would you liken that at all to working with, you know, artists and stuff on the book? Is it kind of like you pitch a crazy idea and they're like, well, what about this crazier idea?
Yeah. I mean, I've always likened the co-creator relationship to being like dating. Because it's very intense and very personal, and you get very close. And then you discover stuff about each other that you kind of can't stand. And then when your book is done, like, you kind of have to take a break and see other people. but yeah, right. A lot of, like, that sort of, you know, when you click with a collaborator, like, yeah, that sort of, you guys start sharing a headspace, and, you know, they will send you something that completely changes your mind about what you were doing in this story and takes it off in a whole new direction. So, yeah, I never noticed that similarity, but I would say it's pretty apt.
We were recently talking...
Well, you're welcome.
Yeah. Thank you.
We were recently talking on the show about multiple writers writing one comic series, and I know that with Evolution, you're collaborating with two, sometimes three other writers. What is that process like?
We do most of our collaboration at the start of each arc. So we'll get together and sit in a room and kind of pitch each other, like, here's what I want to do with my story. And, you know, here's where we need to go as a unit. So we basically, we're basically telling each other our stories, and then other people will jump in and be like, well, what about this and that? So we're all kind of workshopping our stories together, and then that's the most, like, sort of group part of it, and then we go off and do our own thing, and then it all comes back together after that with our editor and starts sort of blending it together. So it's, I did another writer's room. I did one for the Alien, the Prometheus thing.
I was curious if that happens with franchise books. I was just going to ask. Yeah.
That one we did, like, it was just a bunch of Portland writers. So we all met at our editor's house. But it was the same thing. It was like, you know, everybody gets together. We sort of talk each other through our stories. Everybody sort of helps tweak them to make them better. And then, you know, it's like you're in a huddle, and then somebody yells break, and you all separate and go write your stuff. So it's not too different from regular writing. It's just you have to be more social in between.
Right. Make concessions and collaborate. Yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah.
Sure, absolutely. Is there a little bit of a fear that, you know, is the editor essentially the final word there? Is there a little bit of a fear that, like, there's favorite childism? Or do you feel really great when you are the favorite child?
I didn't think of that. Yeah, I try not to, worry about that stuff. But yeah, I mean, it's, you know, a little bit of a competition, I think, is in there.
Which makes it better, probably.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's hard to be competitive as a writer. It's like, you know what, I put these words together better than you did. Like, so yeah, that's sort of the one time where you're really like, oh crap, like that's a really good idea. Now I have to do something even better to like show them up.
You know, speaking of, it almost sounds like a good way to get through writer's block, right? Where you're kind of putting everyone together and like feeding off of each other's energy. Folie à deux, in a way. I know you've also worked on I Lived in a Clown Motel and Pool Disaster and another one, Coffee Shop Dog. And you call those books that you have, they're kind of secondary or parallel to your comic work. You have a name for that, press or garbage can press, trash can press?
But so the press is two-headed press, mm-hmm. But the zines, I call them the dumpstronaut.
There we go. That's what it was. Yep.
Like astronaut, but for stupid.
Got it.
Would you say that working on those projects is also a little bit of a way of working through writer's block for you? Is it nice to turn your energies towards something that isn't as high profile or as tight on deadlines as, say, something like Shanghai Red?
I would say that, except every one of those that I've done has been assembled like the week before a convention when I realized, oh crap, I have to put in the order now. So they end up being these rush things that sometimes I'll stay up all night making. The Clown Motel zine, especially, like if you read that thing, you can, I made the whole thing like over 24 hours, and you can, as you read it, you can see like not just me going crazy in the story, but like me going crazy as a designer and just like fitting more and more boxes in. But it's a nice, outlet, I guess. It's, you know, comics is so collaborative that it's nice to have this thing that I can just sort of go off and do myself and nobody's waiting on me. And I don't have to, there's nobody to say no.
Sure.
So I can kind of just do whatever, and the public kind of decides, like, is this a success? Is it not? Like, I just kind of judge on how much I sell of anything to determine whether or not it's a success. I don't think Coffee Shop Dog was a success, but I don't know.
Hey, I have all three, and I like them very much, so thank you.
Sure, yeah. But you know, it's the nice thing about it is like, there's not a lot of pressure. Like if I put out Coffee Shop Dog and it doesn't blow the doors off, like I still sold through my print run. So,
sure.
And I still got a really stupid zine out of it. So, it's all worth it to me. And yeah, it's just like completely separate from writing. So it's a nice way to kind of turn my brain off.
And Clown Motel, which is ostensibly a story about you losing your mind in the Tapanah, Nevada desert, staying at a clown motel for a month after idiots like mm-hmm. myself kickstarted you to stay there.
Yep.
I'm sorry, by the
way. That's cool.
That one is on its third printing or fourth printing? The third printing sold out, is that right?
Yeah, well, there's been three versions. So
three versions, okay.
Yeah, so I'm on the third version now with the Francesco Francavilla cover. So the first print run sold out. I'm getting more made now, so I'll have them at Emerald City and other conventions this year. But yeah, for whatever reason, that you know, I thought when I drove away from the Clown Motel, I was like, okay, well, this is done. Like nobody's gonna care about this anymore. And you know, it's 4 years later, and we're still talking about it. So. You never know, like, what thing is going to, like, lodge itself in the consciousness of the world.
Sure, absolutely. Speaking of lodging itself in the consciousness of the world, I recently reviewed Shanghai Red, you and Joshua Higson's book, from Image, in trade collection came out recently. I reviewed it for our site, AIPTComics.com. I loved it very much. Kind of a John Wickian revenge story about a woman who was shanghaied into servitude on a boat and then kind of takes revenge on her captors, as well as the whole system that enabled that process, taking it all the way back to Portland, where you live or are from. True? Yes? I know.
Not from.
Okay. I really loved that turn there at the end where were you getting a little bit of aggression out there at the end when she's just like, fuck Portland?
there's always a low-key sort of aggression towards Portland inside me. That two-page spread in the last chapter, I guess, was definitely – I wrote that at a time where, like, rents were going up and – I was, like, wondering if I could live here anymore. So yeah, like, I love this city, but I also kind of give it a lot of side eye, too.
Sure. And in my review about the book, I noticed, you know, ostensibly it is a really bloody, brutal, action-oriented revenge story. And I use the word John Wickian. And I think on the surface, it's definitely that. But there's a lot of other things there, too, like the Portland dig, which I appreciated knowing that you're writing from Portland. But also there's a scene between Red and her sister where she says, "Do I look like a monster?" And her sister returns, "You look like a man." And she says, "That's what I meant."
Yeah.
And I really love that very much. And what is the process like for you where you're basically writing or you're imagining a story that's like, we're going to write something that's hyper-violent, that is, you know, people breaking bottles and smashing bricks on each other's heads, but I also want it to mean something. And how do you imagine marrying those two things at the narrative level?
I hope for the best. I never set out with like this, I never set out to like with my themes already established, you know, I never sit down and be like, okay, this is a book about, such a thing or, you know, this, that, or the other. The story and the characters are foremost to me and they kind of drive everything, but especially the characters. So there, you know, there has to be something to them. They can't just be ciphers. You know, they have to be real living people for me to give a shit about them. So I spend a lot of time figuring out who my characters are, and you know, that I think that more than anything, I tend to stumble on like, oh, here's what I want this to be about. I don't know if that makes sense or not, but
no,
like,
absolutely. Yeah.
I knew I wanted to do, you know, just a sort of cool revenge thriller set in this time period that like that you don't normally see things set, you know, it's sort of like, although Red Dead Redemption 2 sort of takes place in the exact same time period that we're at. So, but it's like this era where like the cowboy age is over, but the car hasn't showed up to revolutionize things. So it's this weird in-between period. And I just thought there was something about that period that would be cool to explore. And then, yeah, then suddenly it became about family relationships and it became about identity. Because the more I dug into the characters, the more that stuff like jumped out and was like, oh, okay, I guess this is what this book is about.
Sure, yeah. And, you know, I think even reading through the back matter of the book, that definitely spoke to me. The time and attention that you put into all the character right from the very beginning is really apparent, you know, read in everyone else's descriptions. That totally makes sense. And it's obvious in the narrative too. And I definitely appreciate writers like yourself that take the time to do that because it gives it so much more to chew on.
Yeah. And it's, you know, that's how I keep myself invested. Like, I briefly fell into a weird period where I was pitching books to editors, and it was like the way I was writing my pitches was like it was all about the concept, and then sort of tacked on was like, oh, and here are who the characters are. And I was getting no hits on this stuff. Like Crowded was one of the ones I pitched it to an editor, and he was like, well, like the concept is cool, but we don't know if there's really like anything there beyond that. And I had to step back and realize like, right. Like I need to lead with the characters. Like they're the important thing because they carry the story. Like, you know, your hook or your concept can only take you so far. There has to be something weightier behind it just to keep you as a creator interested. Otherwise it's just like, I don't know. It's just like rattling off cool ideas, right. And which is, you know, fun to do, but ultimately like pretty forgettable.
And speaking of that, you know, you are one of the better writers in terms of representation that I've seen in comics. You know, I know you have quite a few lesbian and bisexual characters in your comics, and I think there's something to be said for Red in Shanghai Red being red. There's a lot of red in that sentence.
Pile it on.
As either, you know, non-binary or trans, depending on who's reading it, and I appreciated that very much. And I, you know, I... This isn't necessarily a question so much as saying I really appreciate that very much, and I appreciate that you're writing from that viewpoint, and I think people should check books out based on that premise alone. Yeah,
I mean, I'm, you know, I just kind of realized once I got my foot in the door that I just, you know, like there's so much stuff about straight white dudes.
yeah.
Like there's an endless amount of stories about those people. And as a white dude, I live with myself all the time, and I certainly don't want to, like, you know, it's just easier for me to sort of, if I put myself in the shoes of somebody who isn't me, which is why I tend to write a lot of women characters, because like I just don't want to fall in the default, I guess, and turn things into like a weird Gary Sue or whatever. So I think, you know, it helps me build my empathy, honestly, like which I think everybody can work on. So, yeah, I don't know. It just feels right to me, I guess.
Sure.
And so far, like, yeah, all the pushback I've gotten has been from people who have pretty much proved my point in the first place. So,
yeah, I mean, I think that's a great compliment in and to itself.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
Yeah. And speaking of that, you know, I kind of feel like, and if my read of this is wrong, please feel free to tell me, but Crowded, which stars a bunch of female characters, and it almost feels to me like the core concept of that book, which is about a on-demand Uber or Lyft or Uber Eats or Grubhub murder-for-hire application service, basically feels like a fuck you to straight white men that own services like Tesla and Uber and stuff like that.
It's definitely, you know, that's again, like, that was a book that, like, had the concept and figured out the characters, and then only realized when I had to sort of sketch out in detail the rest of the book that that the apocalypse that's taking place in this book, it's a world where the tech bros from Silicon Valley won. Right. So, like, it's a world where suddenly government just rolled over and was like, oh, yeah, well, clearly, you know, you guys just invented the bus and you just invented, you know, convenience stores. Like, we're just going to hand over the reins and, like, you guys have great ideas. What could go wrong? So that's sort of the world that Crowded is a world where nobody said no to Silicon Valley.
Yeah, and it feels so timely, you know.
Yeah, I don't intend for it to necessarily be a direct commentary on what's going on now, but, you know, yeah, I couldn't write this book unless I was living through all this shit going on right now.
What is that app, TaskRabbit? Do you think people are actually using it to kill people already?
I'm sure it's possible. Fiverr, I mean, maybe.
People were using what's the dark web marketplace? Silk Road?
Yeah.
I haven't heard that one.
That was the hook on Silk Road, that people were actually putting out hits on Silk Road. Yeah.
I mean, and there are people on Tor who, you know, have websites that are like, I am, you know, an assassin for hire, like, and here's how you reach me. So, you know, yeah, it's not the scariest thing about the coming up with that concept and like being so excited about it was I was convinced that somebody was going to get to it before us. And then nobody did. But then I was worried that like the real world would be right. Like,
sure.
Just things started just feeling like, man, things are really going crazy. Like, I would not be surprised if like this actually came to pass, and I don't want to be blamed for it. So,
yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned doing research for House of Mug. Did you also have to do research on Tor and Silk Road and all sorts of stuff like that for Crowded?
I mean, I did really. I tend to know a little bit about it, and I figured that was enough. Like, I didn't want it to. I feel like that has become the new sort of go-to explanation for anything. It's like, oh, it's on the dark web.
Right.
Like, oh, it's on, you know, yeah. So I kind of kept that stuff nebulous. I mean, the most research I did was finding out, like, what jobs you can currently do through apps. So, like, all the stuff I list Charlie doing are things you can do now. And like, I thought I was going to have to make stuff up, and I ended up having a list of like 30 or 40 things like that were more ridiculous than what I listed. So yeah,
could you call out any of the particularly surprising ones?
Like, there is one where you pay somebody to go look at something for you. So like, if you're across the country and like you see a car on eBay, you can basically use this app to say like, hey, go look at this car and like take a bunch of pictures of it and send it to me. I mean, it's sort of like TaskRabbit, but it's more like, yeah, I don't know. Like, it was weird shit like that of, just like using people as like robots basically to be like, go here, do this for me, and report back, and then I'll send you, you know, $20.
Right, it's like an app that's born out of laziness or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like Her. God.
The movie Her? Love that movie.
Okay. Crowded was also optioned by Rebel Wilson, is that correct?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Okay. Crowded was also optioned by Rebel Wilson, picked up by her production studio for, is it a movie or a TV show?
Movie.
Okay. And can you talk about that at all, or is it kind of hush-hush right now?
No, I mean, it's the screenwriter is currently finishing it up. So once that happens, then I guess she takes it around and tries to sell it to somebody, to a studio. So yeah, no, it's just been a really neat process. Like, I got flown out to LA in October to meet with Rebel and the screenwriter. I literally, like, I flew in, met with them, and then got back in a Lyft and went back to the airport and flew home. Yeah, I don't know. It's a thing that like could happen, could not happen.
Sure.
You know, I try to remain cautiously optimistic about this stuff, but this could all fall apart tomorrow. So I hope it does happen. That would be cool. And I feel like Rebel Wilson is like, she's kind of on a good streak right now. But I mean, on our end, it's just like, she really gets the book and she really likes it. And she and the screenwriter are not interested in like you know, doing something 180 degrees different. Like they want it to be the book. So I don't know. Yeah, it feels good, but yeah. Who knows?
Sure. Is it kind of comforting in that sense, handing off something that is essentially your baby to people that are saying, hey, we're going to take care of this?
Yeah. I mean, ultimately, you know, I know that anything could happen. And, you know, this, once it leaves your hands, who knows what it becomes. You know, I've certainly seen enough adaptations of comics that I love that I thought were not good. But, you know, that doesn't diminish what the book is. Like, I feel like they're two separate entities. Like, it would be awesome if the movie was just like the book. But, you know, if they want to do something different, then I understand that, because that's a whole other industry, and they have a million other people to answer to. So I'm just, you know, I'm just proud to be involved, I guess, however I'm involved. And I just hope there's a big check at the end of it.
That's kind of like the dream, isn't it?
Yeah. Hey, that makes sense. Yeah. Yep. You keep taking all the Lyfts and Ubers you want after that.
Yeah.
Yeah. You step into a fully autonomous lifestyle based off of your book that kind of tears down the whole industry.
No, I would love it if, like, I feel like if Crowded doesn't do it, then somehow Clown Motel will. Like, the stupidest thing I ever did is somehow going to save my life.
Do you feel like the natural conclusion of that is painting your face like the clown from House of 10,000 Corpses at all times?
I already did that.
I know.
That was a couple of years ago. No, I feel like the only solid conclusion I can think of is that somehow I come anew enough money that I buy it. And then I just, like, live. Not all year, but, like, part of the year. I live in Tonopah, Nevada.
Are you satisfied with that conclusion? That sounded almost worrisome.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sort of resigned to it. It wouldn't be the worst thing in the world, especially if I had a car and could go to Vegas or something. Like, I would only live there, like, maybe in the winter, because everything's kind of dead in the winter, at least there. It's not freezing cold.
Sure, yeah. Hey, quick question about that. Did you ever get an answer on the person that sent you out into the wilds with that map?
You know, I can't talk about it. Yeah, I'm gonna leave
okay.
it there.
Okay, the only answer that I will accept is that it was a future version of you.
Yes, yeah, that's okay. Who it was.
Absolutely, great, thank you so much. Hey, Chris, thank you so much for joining us. Is there anything else, any future coming projects that you want to let the people know about?
I mean, the Crowded Trade comes out next month, and then the second arc starts in May or June. We might have blown a deadline, so it might be an extra month before it comes back, but we're working on that. And then I've got two new creator-owned books coming out that should be announced soon, one from Aftershock and one from Vault. That's it.
And you'll be at Emerald City Comic Con next month, the 14th through the 17th?
Yeah, I'm awesome. Tabling somewhere there. I don't know where, but I'm in the guide, I guess.
Awesome. I'll stop by.
All right, cool.
Cool. Thanks, man.
Thanks so much for your time. This was fun.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, guys, that's our show. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please like, subscribe, retweet. Please share with your friends. I just want to point out, tomorrow, X-Men Monday starts. This is the first of a weekly column where we team up with Jordan White, the editor of X-Men Comics, and we have your answers answered by Jordan in a column feature. And in it, we also have some exclusive art of upcoming X-Men books. This is your, like, number one place to go for X-Men news and insider info. And we're really, really excited for this to kick off. And that's tomorrow, Monday. And it's X-Men Monday. That's the name of it.
When I get a chance, I'm just going to ask him, X-23, best mutant, true or false? And that's going to completely paint my experience with X-Men Mondays, but it should not paint yours.
You know, you should. Have you? Did you submit any questions?
They're I all did not. I didn't want to get in the way of the fans.
Yep.
But I will soon.
Nice. All right, guys. Thanks for listening. And that's our show.
See ya.
And thanks to Christopher Sabella.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thanks, guys. Bye.
See ya.